Welcome to Obsessed with Design, a show about what makes designers tick. My name's Josh Miles. I'm a designer and principal at Miles Herndon, a branding agency in beautiful downtown Indianapolis. Today on Obsessed with Design, I've got a treat for you. If you missed my conversation with Douglas Davis, we're going to replay that for you today. And if you did hear it, I have a feeling you'll enjoy listening to it again because it's been one of our most popular episodes to date. Douglas is a freelance creative director, designer, design instructor, and author of the book, Creative Strategy and the Business of Design. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Douglas Davis. All right, guys, welcome all the way from Brooklyn, author of Creative Strategy and the Business of Design, digital marketer, freelance art and creative director, advertising and design educator, Douglas Davis. Douglas, thanks for being on Obsessed with Design.
Thank you for having me, Josh. I know it's a mouthful, so I apologize in advance for all those different titles there.
We were joking around with our guest last week, Bob Ewing, that he needs to let a few of these things go because he had too many, but I think you may have almost like doubled his list. So nice work. You know,
the crazy thing about it is that if I didn't have these different titles, I wouldn't actually know what day it is because based on the hat that I need to wear, that's how I actually know what day it is. So if I take anything out, you know, I may shorten my week in a dangerous way. So
I hear that. So you and I actually got introduced because I had reached out to the guys at Howe and we're chatting to them about something else. And they were like, oh, hey, you need to meet Doug. You need to see about this book. And I bet he'd be a good fit for the show. So I tracked you down and I'm glad we did.
Yeah, I'm glad we did as well. Yeah. I'll just thank you to those guys for putting me on your radar.
Well, they were kind enough to shoot me a copy, and I will admit that I'm about 50 pages into it, and I'm digging the book so far. It's definitely personally right up my alley. So, guys, if you're listening, be sure to check out Creative Strategy and the Business of Design, available on Amazon. We'll talk a little bit about that later. But, Douglas, I'm curious how you got hooked up with Howe in the first place. What was the introduction, or how'd they find you, or vice versa?
Yeah, so LinkedIn. I mean, I think it was probably about late summer 2012. Someone from Howe Design University reached out. They wanted to start ramping up their professional development for designers. They wanted a course that focused on my sweet spot, which is design as well as strategy. And this was for an online workshop. And it's like, online class, you get to experience the class at your leisure, 4 lessons across 4 weeks. And after 9 4-week offerings later, they had made about 17 grand. And so that got my attention concerning the content resonating with the design community. So that led to a whole bunch of other things.
Oh, that's awesome. That's pretty speedy too.
Yeah, it was. I was surprised as well. I think my eyes were so wide. I was like, "What? Wow!
You did what?
Maybe I'm not the only one going through this."
You know, between your list of things, and maybe it's hard to know which hat to answer this question from. But what's kind of your origin story? What's your background that got you into this creative world of design and advertising?
Wow. Well, I mean, if I go way back, if you remember those Draw Me pamphlets with the pirate or the turtle on them, I go way, way back. But I do remember just my passion for art and drawing started when my cousins took me to the state fair. I'm from South Carolina originally. They won one of those mirrors where they were throwing the darts at the balloons. And I went home that night and decided for whatever reason to draw Garfield. And after my mom asked me, did I trace, you know, this? And I said, no. That was really the beginning of my interest in art. But we fast forward a bit to talk about my entry into the design world. it becomes the story of the professor who had no intention of going to college. It's funny that during my high school sort of junior year, I don't know where I was thinking coming up with this stuff, but I thought to myself, you know, if I don't go to college, I want to make sure that it was because I decided not to go versus the fact that I could not go. So I went to summer school voluntarily. I started taking the SAT 3 times just to get the best score possible. And then when I finally graduated, I had no plan, and having applied to a grand total of 0 colleges, I stumbled onto a recruiting conversation about Hampton University. And while I was volunteering, because I had all the requirements, exposure in a sense meant that opportunity. And it's funny that I was going to enroll in the fashion merchandising program. And when I finally got to Virginia, 6 hours later, when I got there, I found out that they had phased that program out. And so I chose graphic design. And if I fast forward one more time, just to talk about the strategy and the marketing part of this, I'm in New York after completing my master's in communications design at Pratt. I'm freelancing at an advertising agency for a few months where I'm pretty much bored, but I love hanging out with the people that I'm working with. And after about 3 months, you know, they didn't really need me to set the headlines and the images. I wasn't doing anything conceptual. It was just sort of, you know, there freelancing. And I was working on the HSBC account. And then one day someone in a panic comes into the conference room and they're like, the client needs a website. And after I paused a bit, and this is back in probably like maybe 2004, 2005. After that person comes in a panic, I raise my hand and I say, well, I know how to do that. And from there, I start to talk through all the ways that we've basically for the last 3 months left money on the table because we weren't offering digital. And I just went down the litany of clients that we were serving, talked about what the missed opportunities were. And so I ended up pitching the creative director and the CEO of the agency. And at that point, they allowed me to start the digital arm of this little boutique agency within JWT. From there, we had a great 18-month run. But after a while, I realized that I started losing battles because I wasn't able to justify the business and marketing considerations. I wasn't able to talk about what I needed in terms of staffing in the context of how it was or was not going to solve the client's business problem. And so I would fall back on my aesthetic vocabulary because I didn't understand what strategy or business was because I wasn't taught that in design school, even though I was able to do really well at a very young age. And so that really started my quest to become the creative who understood business. So that's how I got into art. I guess I could say it was a bit of a progression. Art led to design, which led to advertising or marketing strategy.
Yeah, and it's you know, it's few and far between clients who really don't gloss over when you start talking about white space and kerning and pixel dimensions and all this stuff. But it, you know, as you talk about in the book, you know, learning the language of business and figuring out how to apply that across creative strategies, I think is pretty essential for anybody that wants to move up the ladder.
Absolutely. And it's very interesting because as we as creative professionals do what we were trained to do in terms of solving client problems, we're rewarded for that excellence in that design execution or the ability to craft that app or to come up with a really interesting website that people end up responding to. And so therefore you find yourself in a different room with different responsibilities where there's a completely different conversation happening, and it happens to be in the same spot where it was outside of the scope of what your design training was, because now we're talking the language that's spoken on the other side of the brain. And so I was completely unprepared for those conversations. And I did my best, but it's pretty frustrating at times whenever you know that something is the right way to go creatively, but you can't articulate it in a way that would allow others to see what your point of view is, or maybe even to tamp down on some of the fear in the room, or you know, increase the trust in this crazy, you know, creative person that, you know, that's the right way to go. It can get really challenging that you get rewarded for doing what you do well, but then you do have to seek to gain skills that you weren't necessarily trained on in order to do well at that next phase.
So connect a few of the dots for us here too, for, you know, fast forward from that digital role to today, you're doing your own thing, you're teaching, you're writing, you know, where did those things come into play, and how much longer were you with that agency before you decided to pursue some of these other ideas?
You know, this is a wild story. One of my first creative partners and I basically reached out to him whenever they were allowing me, probably the youngest person at the agency, to become the head of this new digital arm. And, you know, we were freelancing there on a whole host of clients for about 18 months. We had a pretty good run, but we were also freelancing on the side, and we kind of messed up and won a large piece of business on the side. So now I have a full-time and I have this other account. We were poached to a different agency. And it's funny because my friend left first because he was a freelancer, but I was the only one that was full-time. And so I remember, like it was yesterday, the creative director screaming at me because I didn't tell him that this other guy was leaving. And then he asked me what I was going to do. You know, and I said, well, I'm going to preserve the partnership. And then he says, well, what do you want? And I was like, well, I want $100,000 and no boss. And I'm a little kid at this point. He laughs at me. And little did he know, I already had that from the people who hired us to sort of continue with this other account that we won. So we left there in about 18 months. And what was great about that experience is that I then stumbled into a strategy session at this new agency. And I've never, ever been into one before. I didn't understand really, I guess I could describe the format in my, at that time, my perception of the format of a strategy meeting was like I was brainstorming for a chess match or something. And sitting down there, I realized that, oh, this is the thing that I've been needing to understand. Here it is. You know, I could recognize what it was, but I didn't understand it as a discipline. And so it was just great to be there and to learn a lot more. And then from there, I continued to bounce around. And after winning an equally large piece of business some years later, I realized that, you know, hey, it's probably time to become an LLC with this client. You know, it's unincorporated business taxes. Filing that every year is great and all, but I think it's probably time to become a little bit more formal about this. And so I put my shingle out there and continue to reach out to people who I had met along the way to help me out.
So maybe not to sidetrack us too far, but how did you know what to do, or who did you lean on, like to know that you needed to get incorporated, or, you know, was that just kind of the DIY thing, or did you get an attorney or an accountant to help, or did you have a business partner?
I did have an accountant, and I still work with that accountant. I don't know that the prompt came from him though. I think I was realizing that, you know, at that point, you know, after being married, about to get some property, I realized that I needed to probably have a bit more protection concerning my finances that were personal and was business. But overall, I also realized that after being in the business for maybe, I think at that point, it was probably about 13 years, or maybe 12, 13 years, that it was time to be a bit more formal so that I can grab larger pieces of business. And it wouldn't be like, oh, yeah, well, I'm a freelancer, but I'm pitching. I have the experience, but I'm still a freelancer. Just added, sure, formality to things that will allow me to credibly go after larger pieces of business.
Cool. I think that's helpful. And like you said, stumbling into that strategy brainstorming meeting, I think that's where, a lot of young designers find themselves on the business side. They're like, well, I sort of have heard of these things called incorporation or whatever, but they don't know where to start.
Yeah, there are a lot of resources out there, from the Freelancers Union to what Elise Benin does with MarketingMentor.com. There are quite a bit of resources out there, and I think it's going to be really important to any young designers listening to make sure that they are involved with like the Indianapolis chapter, the AIGA, or whatever their local chapter or the AIGA is. It's just really important to make sure that you are plugged into that design community. That's one of the keys to survival, I believe.
Cool. So maybe let's circle back to where you were going with the story about kind of how this brought you to the teaching and the writing side.
Absolutely. So what's interesting is that, and this is something that I've had to pay attention to myself over time to learn. And I hope that the creatives listening are paying attention. If you hate something, try to understand why. If you love something, try to understand why. And because oftentimes we're people of extremes. I think, when you do have such a extreme reaction on one side or the other, it's important to pay attention. But from those reactions, I've realized that I need three outlets to remain stable in order to not to be bored, I believe. I can say it that way. I have an artistic outlet, a strategic outlet, and a client service outlet, because I do like people. And, the artistic outlet is really the teaching undergraduates. Or teaching young designers who are in the field how to become more strategic. I love taking someone who has a raw talent or an interest, like much like I did when I was young, in drawing or illustration or writing, and then helping them to turn that interest and that raw talent into something that's polished and viable. And it's amazing whenever those students get jobs that I've held before. And that's one of the artistic benefits. I need that outlet to help people to use what they have. The strategic side of things, I teach in the graduate program in the Branding and Integrated Communications program. It's a master's in professional studies at City College. And that came about just for the same way that I stumbled into that strategy session. I do love the elevated conversation of sort of how you twist the Rubik's Cube. I don't believe that there's necessarily a right way or a wrong way to solve a solution. It's just how you twist the Rubik's Cube, what your right answer is and why you think it's right. And so it's great to take graduate students and expose them to real clients and have them simulate the process that you and I go through every day in our design firms or in different creative projects. And then the client service outlet, opening the Davis Group LLC was exactly sort of the extension of what I was doing since the days at Pratt. It's funny because Pratt, I always say Pratt didn't prepare me to get a job. Pratt prepared me for when there were no jobs.
So that's a great point.
And I think that has been the way that I not only pay the mortgage, but pay for my family. And it's been great to say that I could make a living as a creative person doing what I do. And I can work for myself. I'm on my couch in my living room downstairs right now, even though I've been at work all day. So those are the three outlets that I need to have. And it does help to be a fan of the industry, just as I'm also a practitioner. I love design. I love what we do. I love to talk to people about what we do. I love to experience what we do all over the world. So those are my three outlets.
So when it comes to like making and doing right now, what are some of your favorite things to work on in that category?
You know, it's interesting because I'm really, really now exploring the words behind the pictures. I'm in the infancy of my exploration of words. And I was a trained graphic designer and then later an art director. I came from the visual side of things. And now I'm finding the beauty and the creativity that is expressed in words. When I was at Pratt, distinguished typographer Tony Despina, he was a partner of Herb Lubalin back in the day. He was my professor, and he would say, you know, it's been said a picture's worth a thousand words, but in the hands of the right designer, a word is worth a thousand pictures. And that always stuck in my head. And so I think one of the things that I really enjoy doing right now these days is I love writing witty lines. I love, you know, writing words that inspire images. That's what I'm really into. And it's great because it allows me to focus on the process of creativity. And that's what I'm focused on quite a bit now, working on a project that I'll be presenting tomorrow in Philadelphia to Sella Consulting. And really a lot of what I'm doing is filling the gap that is left between creative people not studying business and business people in business school not being taught how to inspire creatives. So words can inspire pictures, visual language, I guess.
And that quote from Tony, he was the one that did the script work on your book. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, yes. So I came up with this awful scribble because he's amazing. And I really, a lot of time, it's funny now, I used to draw with so many details. And now I use thumbnails and just to get down a gesture of the actual idea itself. So I sketched this brain that was Spencerian script, terrible sketch. And I take great pride in being able to hire the best people, but it's even sweeter when they happen to have taught you. So to hire my professor, it was great.
That's pretty awesome. And of course his pedigree and working with Herb, that's I'm sure lots of stories there.
So many stories, man. It's funny, art school at Pratt and different times throughout the years, I went to continuing education classes at SVA. I'm always in a class. I always like to learn something, regardless of how many master's degrees I have or what I've done before. I'm never too old to learn something, I hope. But it's funny because I think back to those classes and I was so involved in the stories that they would tell, these designers who would work with people like Massimo Vignelli and Saul Bass and Herb Lubalin and all these different people. And it would be very difficult to know when to take notes because the stories were so interesting. And so there were so many stories and then eventually I'd be like, oh my gosh, I think I'm supposed to write this down. So story, a large part of what we do and definitely a large part of art school.
Yeah, similarly, one of my professors studied under Paul Rand when he was at Yale. So it's, you know, we would get all these awesome Paul Rand stories and everything from, you know, how he interacted with a printer and how he would look at proofs to like how he determined he should dress and how he told others they needed to dress to present themselves and just all these little nuggets of wisdom. It's so cool to pick those up. So I was reading in your book a little bit, and I love the story about the conference that you got invited to speak at that was in Russia. So fill us in a little bit on the background of that story.
In New York, everybody knows somebody. So I had a few Russian students. So I showed them this invite and they were like, no, like that's legit. And so immediately I'm thinking to myself, it's like, they're inviting me to speak, to do what I do. So my wife and I, we get really excited. We're starting to plan things. We know some people in Moscow. So we're like, we'll make a little mini vacation out of it. And fast forward, I'm on stage and the conversation starts in Russian. So I can't understand a thing. And at that point, I had just met the translator maybe an hour early. And he made me feel really at ease. He was saying, you know, like people should feel like we've worked together for years. So when I'm on stage, when I would say a lot, he would translate for a little while. But then when I would say a little bit, he would say, go on. And so I would keep talking, but he would only translate for a little while. So it would just be like, it was very difficult to understand if I connected with the audience or not. So four speakers were there. He was the only translator the whole time. So I say to my wife, when I get down from the stage, I say, hey, that was kind of weird. I didn't know, you know, you're being translated. You don't know whether people understood anything. So after the whole day of the conference, he's translated three individual presentations and three panel discussions. Sorry, four, because there are four of us. So we're all congratulating him and saying how much he's worked, because we only had to give one presentation and speak on one panel. And I turn to him and I say, you know, thank you so much, because without you, we wouldn't have been able to actually connect with the audience. And he turns to me and he says, actually, I didn't know how to communicate most of what you guys were saying. So if you can imagine, Josh, like, so I get that deep eye gaze with this guy for about like, you know, half a minute just to see if he's joking. He's not joking. And so at that point, after all of that work flying all the way out here, they pay me double my rate, paid all the expenses. My wife is there as well. This guy says he didn't really know how to translate most of what we were saying. I say to him, that was worth it just for the story. The interesting thing about this is that when you really think about how things are changing in our field in design, I feel like business is annexing design just like it integrated marketing years ago. That's what I think. Mm-hmm. That's what I've seen in the different trends. And I can go into that if we have time.
Yeah, tell me what, unpack that a little bit for us.
If you look at some of the press releases that have been out lately, just over the last year, McKinsey and Company, they had this I guess white paper or opinion piece called Building a Design Driven Culture. And they basically make the point that you can't just engage people with the products and services that you make. You have to engage them on a deeper level. And they were talking about how to use design to do that. In order to figure out why someone wants something versus just understanding that they may or may not like what you have. This is really about differentiation and getting deep down into insights. You can look at companies becoming media properties, such as GoPro. There's so many companies that are really now starting to create their own content. So I feel like our design jobs, just in these examples, they're, you know, McKinsey is not the only company. There are a lot of them that are also acquiring design capabilities, advertising agencies, IBM, for instance. They're acquiring what we do. The New York Times just recently has also acquired a marketing or design agency. So I look at that and I see that design is becoming way more, even more important to business than it was before, because of the fact that business is annexing it in order to have differentiation and in order to compete. So the Russia story was interesting because of the premise that in design school, we weren't taught business. But yet, what we're doing in terms of communication, a lot of our clients, in terms of what I've seen, especially if design is being annexed, I've seen a lot of client expectations go from asking me as a creative content creator. They've also asked me for strategic context.
Mm-hmm.
So as things continue to evolve, I think the client's expectations are also evolving because they're expecting everyone involved with their brand to be strategic. Now, on the other side, the business side, and I can only say this after going through NYU and learning business, I realized that business school doesn't teach how to inspire designers. So think about the times that you've left a creative kickoff meeting with either someone internally or an actual client, and you've left with like a bloated brief with like the kitchen sink, everything in there, like thick as a phone book, but yet none of it in there really. You have to sort through it all. It's not really helping you because there's so much there, wasn't really sifted or curated to inspire you. Or there's essential information missing from the brief, and or there is no process.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is that with the Russia story, and the point that I make often in the book is that as a designer, as a creative, because the business and marketing environment that we create for is evolving, we have to evolve our skills. And it's very ironic that the very training from either business school or marketing or design school that sort of allows us to become professionals and qualified to be in the room together, it leaves out the communication part that allows us to actually talk to each other, even though we're responsible for communicating on behalf of the brand to a target. So with the Russia story, I just find it ironic that it mimics a lot of the interaction between groups who are in the room, but they don't know what each other's talking about. They don't have the language to really serve the client. And at the end of the day, the client is going to make up his or her mind that the agency is not strategic enough because of our internal communication issues, the gaps there. And it really doesn't matter when they pull the business whose fault it is.
Right. Yeah, it's really like a literal example of you could just see this being edited on the fly. You know, you're giving this guy all of these words and he just picked a few and translated the ones that made sense to him and pushed those along, where, you know, at the client and agency level, that exact same thing has happened. It's not a foreign language. These are all words we understand, but we don't really understand what the other party's talking about.
Exactly. And it leads to, you know, the process when the creative process is confusing. How the heck are we supposed to be successful at visual communication?
Right.
It's like a game of telephone, you know?
Yeah, you're just kind of setting up for the big lose there. So what do you think in that context? I mean, you're obviously putting some responsibility on us as the creative team, and I completely agree with that. But as you're making those initial contacts or you're kind of doing the initial dance, what do you think makes for a really great client, or how do you set up what a good client relationship looks like?
Right. And I think you have to create good clients, just like you have to create quality relationships. And obviously they're the same thing, they're relationships. And I say you have to create a good client because it is on us to lead the client. Half the time when clients come to us with vague information or incomplete information, it's because they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I really do believe that even though there's an infinite amount of things that our clients come to us for in terms of types of projects and things that we could be designing for them. They all really come to us with the exact same request, no matter how it sounds. They're asking us to solve their problem. So I think as a result, it's up to us to lead them. And leading the client, I think, and creating a great business relationship is understanding how they define success in their language, and then speaking that language back to them in order to instill or to earn the trust that we're going to need in order for them to trust us to do the part of our job that's more familiar to us, but foreign to them. And I think that you create great client interaction when you're prepared to lead the client, when you know just as much about their business and maybe even more because you're looking at it from fresh eyes from the outside. When you can walk into that meeting and based on the questions that you ask, show that you've literally not only scoured their website, but you've scoured the places that their customers are, and you've looked at not only what they say about themselves, but you've looked at what the customers say about their products, and you're able to talk about that freely. And then maybe even question some of the answers that the client came to you with and drill down a bit further and maybe even say, hey, you know, I know you guys think your problem is this, but it's actually that. I've won business like that. Because when I did ask the client, say, hey, why'd you choose my group? And the response was because you challenged us. Mm. And I back and I realized that I walked into the room after reading the brief and after looking at what they define the problem as, I realized that I had a very strong opinion about the fact that that was not their problem, was actually this other thing. But without the ability to articulate that in the business terms that they would understand, mm-hmm. I don't know that I would have been able to gain the trust in order to close the deal. So I think you create great client relationships by dealing with the fear in the room, by making sure that you can speak the same language. You eliminate confusion.
So if the onus is kind of on the designer to make the relationship work, are there still things for you that are potential deal killers or red flags that you watch out for?
Absolutely. I remember maybe about 3 years ago, very, very articulate, and like almost way more articulate than usual, prospect contacted me on LinkedIn, asked me for three references, checked those references, had long conversations with everyone. And after about a 3 week vetting process, wanted to meet me. I took a 45 minute train ride out. They took me out to a really nice dinner where I met this prospect and the business partner. They were siblings. So I asked during this initial meeting if they had a business plan. And the answer was no. And my spidey sense is tingling. The flags are like aping like crazy. But I continue to ask questions and try to figure out, okay, so how do I help these people to understand that maybe they'll need a business plan? We start talking a bit more and they tell me what their idea is after I sign an NDA. It's terrible. Never going to work. Another business, existing business that has way more capital, all this other stuff. Just, it's not going to work. Awful. So red flags again, like waving, blinking, flashing lights. And for some reason, I was trying to determine a way that I could actually help them. So I proposed to them a 16-hour discovery where I would go through certain business principles and tools and determine viability for their idea. At that point, they could take my recommendations and we could either keep going or they could take my recommendations and we could part ways. Mm-hmm. So I thought this would be the way around this. So after about 3 weeks, after I give the presentation, it's about 96 slides. I give the presentation, wait for 3 weeks. They call back. I'm thinking, oh, wow, they must have taken my advice and looked at ways to retool this idea to make it original, first of all, but just to figure out how to make it viable. So I write up a proposal. I give them three different options. We go through the process that many of your listeners and, you know, you've gone through hundreds of times, very specific what this outlines for how much money for this amount of time. And after 65 emails to confirm, yes, it includes this. No, it includes, you know, it doesn't include that. This is how much money. This is how much time. These are the resources for clarity. 65.
pretty par for the course, really.
Right. So I'm, you know, they pay the deposit and I'm in my first milestone. So I finished the first milestone and I'm at the client meeting. And I start to present what they've paid me to do. And after 5 minutes, I get interrupted. Douglas, we're really disappointed. We thought we'd be much farther along by this point. I then, baffled and really confused, stop the presentation and start to try to understand what I missed. What did I do that, you know, is not serving my client? And after checking back this, you know, the checking the record of the 65 emails, I realized that these people didn't understand a word of what they paid me to do twice at this point. And so are there certain responsibilities that do not fall on you? Absolutely. And to be honest with you, I had not really gotten – I'd never been in anything like this before. I mean, there's situations where, you know, client drags their feet on paying you, and I've been able to navigate those situations because I am so thorough on my contracts. But this was a completely different – experience where I not only followed professional practice to the letter, but I was now in this twilight zone situation. So at some point, you know, you will be in a situation that you can't win. So yes, there are times when it's not the designer's responsibility, but I feel like nowadays whenever you, and this situation is rare, but I think it really does underscore the responsibility that we have to lead our clients. But there's some clients that no matter how much leading, you're not going to be able to help. So I should have listened to myself.
So the moral of the story here is listen to those spidey senses.
Right. When the moral of the story is no means no, especially when you're
is it a 25 emails or 45 emails, or do you have to get to 62 before you're like, okay, now there's some questions? Like,
exactly.
Listener, you're going to have to decide where to set the bar, but 65 before you move the first pixel is probably more than you're looking for.
Yeah. And I would never get that far in the future. It will never go on.
So let's switch gears a little bit. You know, one of my favorite questions to ask everyone on the show is, which I'm going to ask you too, is what would you say you're most obsessed with right now?
I think I'm obsessed with the words behind the pictures. I'm obsessed with the why behind what things look like. And again, like, you know, I'm not a writer, even though I have this book out. I'm good at what I do, and I've learned how to articulate it, but I'm opinionated. And so I realized that it was an audience after the workshop did so well on how university. So I wrote it down, but I had to have this crazy idea that, hey, I'm going to pitch a book after, you know, never writing one before. So I realized that I'm really interested in the images that come about as a result of words. And so I'm trying to equip creative teams to, I guess, become more inspired, because at the end of the day, if the client doesn't really know what they need strategically, then most of the time, 9 times out of 10, we're going to have to write it ourselves. Mm-hmm. And so I think I'm obsessed with helping people to have the tools to figure out how to harness what's happening right now in business that has implications for us as designers, in order for them to look at what they've been charging and look at the services that they've been offering all along and see the opportunities that they've missed. That's what I'm obsessed with right now.
That's a great point. Like I said, I'm only a whole 50 pages into the book, but I'm just really loving and digging through that. And I'm thinking, okay, this is a book I need to give to, you know, not only read myself, but also share with all of our account managers and with our creative director, production manager, you know, anybody who's going to have a client facing role. I think these are strategies that you can apply directly to add value to that client relationship.
Absolutely. And I'm hoping it also adds tools that allow us, the people who are supposed to be on the same team, as well as, you know, allowing us to help us to reduce the fear in our client-designer relationships. I'm hoping that we can get to the same page and speak the same language within our own team as well, like you're saying. So I definitely agree.
So, Douglas, do you have any dream projects that you'd like to tackle in the future? Anything that you haven't gotten to yet that you're just dying to sink your teeth in?
Yes, actually. this is really interesting. So, you know, we're going to have an election in November. And I've just been really thinking about America as a corporate identity. I wonder, what would America look like under a Trump presidency? What would the visual, what does the flag look like? What does the money look like? What does the Pledge of Allegiance say, copy-wise? You know, what does Air Force One look like? It's really interesting, and obviously, maybe this is one of those dream projects that I hope remains a dream. Who knows, regardless of where you stand, but I think it'd be a really interesting exercise to look at the rebranding of America. Just that, I don't know, I'm really, really interested in that. And I think Trump being such a colorful character, those words have a lot of imagery floating around in my head.
Yeah, I've got a creative contact in Vancouver up in Canada. And he was talking about, you know, something happened locally with the police, and they rolled out in Vancouver, they rolled out these new police cruisers, and they were super intimidating. You know, they're like, they're all blacked out. They're like super aggressive type, and everything about it, you know, the press release that accompanied it that he was talking about on Facebook was about, you know, protection and, you know, being there at your beck and call and serving. And it's a softer message, but he was like, man, they just missed the opportunity to soften the visual identity that goes with this. That when you see that car, you don't think safety, you think, oh shoot.
Yeah, it's signals.
Right.
On purpose.
Exactly. So it's, I think it's, you know, it's that same kind of thing. Like whether it's a sports franchise or a police cruiser or your country, like what that visual identity is saying really speaks a lot in addition to the words that you use.
Absolutely. Maybe sometimes a mixed signals on purpose, who knows, but you know, regardless of what you feel politically, I think it's just been a really interesting thought that I've been kicking around lately. Who would be on the money? What does the money look like now? I don't know. There, you know, what is the national anthem, like if we rewrote the words what would that look like? There's so many things. I mean, when you really think of America and the symbols that we have, it's this huge corporate identity that would be an amazing project to reimagine.
I'm going to be laughing about that idea for a couple of days. I think I love that idea. So maybe along similar lines, you know, as designers, we admittedly see the world differently. And sometimes it feels kind of like the Matrix where you're the only one who's seeing these things. But, you know, what are the things that you see right now, whether it's trends or just things that you're noticing, like what is totally driving you absolutely bonkers right now?
First, I'll say ugly is everywhere. That's the first thing I want to say. And when you really think about the millions of design decisions that are around us every day, from posters to everything in the grocery store, to the iTunes music library, to any book store or online store, commercials keep going. The ugly is everywhere. And I really just see a drop off in typographic exploration. Or even like typographic literacy. I mean, if you just look around and just, I want you just to count all the inch and foot marks that are being used in quotes. It's really bad. It's terrible. And I see it all the time and I'm like, wow, you know, like my goodness. But it's also a good thing. Even though it drives me crazy, I always tell my students that because ugly is everywhere, this is whenever you reach your hand out and you introduce yourself because you know how to do it right. So it's an opportunity, but it definitely rubs me the wrong way.
Yeah, that kind of goes back to you mentioned Massimo Vignelli earlier. You know, a lot of his personal mission was to, as he put it, to rid the world of vulgarity. So it kind of goes along with your ugly is everywhere quotes. That's great.
So I met him twice, actually, at the Obsessive Compulsive Symposium. That's one of the – this is a while back. I think they've changed it. I think it's still says compulsive. But it was at FIT. They used to have this – that's Fashion Institute of Technology. They used to have a design symposium, a workshop series called Obsessive Compulsive. Met Massimo Vignelli.
Oh, cool. That's awesome. Doug, when you're looking for inspiration today, or you know you're having a bad moment, like how do you refocus, or where do you find inspiration?
I think my inspiration comes from people, places, and things. We travel. I love to travel. I beat my past. I feel like I'm a stamp collector in that little book. But I really enjoy the cultures of different types of people. That inspires me regardless of how the day is going, what goes on in terms of a project. My wife and I just returned from Iceland in January. We're going to Petra in Jordan.
Oh, cool.
Just go. And while I'm gone, I always look at patterns and I look at the typography from different languages and how it flows together and whether they're ligatures, even if I can, you know, even if I don't understand the language itself, typography is such a beautiful form. And I try to see the creation in whatever it is, wherever we're at in the world. And so just, I guess people, places, and things, nouns.
I am inspired by nouns.
I'm inspired by nouns.
Love it. So you've mentioned a couple of pretty amazing classic designers. Do you have any particular design heroes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, beyond, as you mentioned, Paul Rand. Massimo Vignelli is definitely one of them. And I mentioned Tony DeSpina earlier. But Tibor Kalman, I love the way he approaches concepts. I feel like he's one of these designers that was so conceptual and so much better than I understood he was at the time. when I was just looking at what he did from a visual standpoint. Now that I can appreciate what he's done, because I'm a little older, I can appreciate the way he did what he did conceptually. That is just really deep. Herb Lubalin, absolutely. Just what he did with typography, I love. Saul Bass, the way that he was able to merge what we do with, you know, on screen. But people who are doing it now, like Rem Duplessis, he was the design director at the New York Times Magazine. Now he's at Apple, but he was also at GQ before Fred Woodward, who was another person, Will Anderson, Paula Scher, Eddie O'Para, you know, everyone at Pentagram, Seymour Quast. There's so many design heroes, and I'm hoping that as we lose some of them, Massimo Mignelli specifically, and Tibbercom, I hope that this new generation, I guess, of which I'm part of, and I hope we can replace, or not replace, but I hope that we can be the people that younger designers name. I hope that we're reaching the same levels. I hope.
Yeah, that's huge. It's a pretty high bar too.
Yeah, it's a high bar.
So as you're working with students or teaching, or kind of in your experience, what's either the best piece of advice you've received, or maybe your favorite piece of advice to share with young designers?
Compete with yourself. Knowing that the Olympics just ended, looking at swimmers or runners, yes, they're competing with the person to the left or to the right of them. But I always tell young designers or students to meet the farthest and fastest that you did the last time. If you can focus on competing with you, then you'll spend time focused on developing your weaknesses and your strengths versus being insecure about the other competition. And at that point, you can be inspired by the talent around you because you see what someone's best looked like, but you're not intimidated at that because you're looking to find your own best, knowing that it looks different from everyone else's.
Yeah.
So
that's great. I was talking to the guys at Ware Stewart a couple weeks ago, and we were joking around about kind of the propensity to hate everything but the most recent project that you've done, which is sort of an overstatement. I don't really hate everything I've ever done that wasn't the most recent one, but I think it's that same sort of idea of like always pushing yourself to get better and always trying to go further than you went that last time around. So I think that, you know, comparison to the Olympic swimmers is really great, as long as we're not, you know, including Lochte in that comparison.
Yes, cannot include him.
So, Doug, before we wrap up here, maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit of where they can track down the book and where they can find you online, and, you know, best places to connect with you.
Any listeners who are interested could definitely find more about Davis Group as well as the book at thinkhowthethink.com. That's my personal site. You could also get at Barnes & Noble, Amazon, or my design shop. Oh, and one last thing, if there's anyone listening who is looking for a reason or it's an excuse to move to New York, or we're contemplating graduate school or something like that, I'd love to meet you in my class, in the Branding and Integrated Communications program at City College. If you're still an undergraduate and you're thinking about moving, it'd be great to meet you at City Tech in the communication design department as well.
Very cool. I know we get some listeners in NYC, so guys, be sure and check out Douglas and that program if that sounds like a good fit. And Sarah, I appreciate you hanging out with us today. Douglas, it's been a pleasure, and thank you for being obsessed with design.
All right, guys, that's episode number 47 in the books. Thank you so much for helping us grow the show this year, and we are looking forward to all of the great interviews coming early next year. Do me a favor this week and send me a tweet to @ObsessedShow or @JoshMiles, and let me know who you think we should interview next. One of our most popular recent episodes with James White at Signal Noise came from the result of somebody tweeting to us and saying, hey, we think you should chat with James. So let me know who you think we should talk to, and maybe your recommendation will make it on a future episode of Obsessed with Design. For all of today's show notes, head over to obsessedshow.com. Also, be sure to head over to iTunes to give us a rating and review to help others find the show. Obsessed with Design is a product of the Design Obsessed team at Miles Herndon, a branding agency located on the 13th floor of beautiful Circle Tower in downtown Indianapolis. Hey, this is kind of silly, but we have got a really fun new voicemail on our answering service. So you should call our office and ask to be put on hold. You guys know what to do. Our intro music is Matchbox Girl by Kazzy Joe, and our show is always edited by Jen Eds at the Brassy Broadcast Company. Visit brassybroad.com to learn more. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.